On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, On the Bookshelf all this month is taking a look at events and people throughout American history, and in particular, African-American history. And so we're delighted for this week to look at a quite extraordinary book, a new photo collection by Rich Cahan, which is entitled River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, Interviews and Photographs of Formerly Enslaved African Americans. It's from City Files Press and is available online and at bookstores everywhere. It's a beautiful hardbound book with incredible photographs. And the photographs themselves have a pretty astonishing story. To talk to us about it is a photo historian and author Richard Cahan. Tell us a little bit about the research that brought you to the point of being involved with this book. This is really quite an incredible book.
This book really was sparked, I'm embarrassed to say it, by the internet.
Huh.
I was, that's how it all started. I went to the Library of Congress site, and in the site, they have a remarkable group of interviews of about 1,500 formerly enslaved men and women that were done in the 1930s by the Works Progress Administration. Out of work writers and journalists went out and they interviewed. They actually ended up interviewing over 3,000 formerly enslaved men and women. And the Library of Congress has most of them, a little more than half of them. And I started researching this several years ago and realized that many of those interviews, or some of them, about 300, were photographed, simple portraits taken oftentimes by the writer. I think at the end of the interview, they would have a kind of a simple camera, and they would say, "Do you mind if I take your photograph?" And the pictures are... At first, you might dismiss the pictures because they were taken by amateurs. These people were mostly writers. They weren't photographers. But if you don't dismiss the pictures and you really look at the content of them, you realize how important they are because they show what these people who were all 75 years and older, these are people that were still living in 1937, what they were wearing, where they were living, what their house looked like. And by combining their words with their portraits, I saw a great power.
Yeah. This is honestly a chilling book to read because these folks, they're older, and when folks get to a certain age in life, they're going to be very blunt. They're going to tell the absolute truth. They're past the point where they feel like they have to tiptoe around the truth. They just tell it like it is. What they have to tell is just how horrible slavery was in America. And all of these were people who were children. Really, for the most part, I mean, there are one or two that were born in the 1840s, but most of them were born in the 1850s or the very early 60s, and they remember being a slave or being an enslaved person, and they remember what it was like to live on a plantation and how people treated them.
Right, and those memories, like many older people, their memories became very detailed. And they really explain, like I've never seen before, in a firsthand way what those experiences were like.
There are a number of them who are from Alabama.
Right.
And some of them are pretty close. You mentioned there are a couple of people who are from Eufaula, Alabama, which is, of course, about an hour away from here.
Right.
And others, Opelika, which is about 2 hours northeast of us. So these were people that, if folks who are listening now were children in Pike County in the 1930s or 40s, that they might have known these people or might have known of these people. And that makes an extraordinary statement in of itself. These are historic characters, even though they may not have thought of themselves in that regard, but they are historic by the witness that they have.
Absolutely. And most of the people who were interviewing them were white, so this was a very difficult experience for some, and many of them referred to that, but they were absolutely determined to dig deep and tell what they experienced.
It certainly puts a big fat lie to the lost myth of the Confederacy that the darkies lived on the plantation and loved it and sang as they picked cotton and everybody was sweet to each other. There were a few of these folks that said, well, yeah, they're their slaveholder was not as bad as the one down the road.
Right.
But.
Right. Exactly.
But.
And I'm so happy that you used the word slaveholder, because language becomes very important here, and I learned a great deal about what is now considered kind of the proper use of language. And one thing that I haven't actually read anywhere else, but the idea of the use of the word slave owner to me seems onerous, because even though legally these people did own slaves, morally can one own anyone else? So I like the term that you're using, a slaveholder.
Yeah. Well, I noticed in the book that was the prevalent yeah. use of it. And I do want to mention, I don't know, this is my favorite quote in the book. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether I want to talk about it now or later. Maybe we'll save it for later. This is from Margaret Nillon, who was born around 1847. And she is one of the last people that you guys have in the book. And I like what she had to say. We're going to save it, because
okay.
it is the, for all intents and purposes, to me, the final word on what slavery was really like. Do we want to talk about some of the things that they said to these interviewers? And like you said, for the interviewers, these were white folks, and that meant that that their ancestors could have been slaveholders. They certainly would have known people that could have been.
Right. And remember, it's the 1930s.
Right.
So for many of these people, they had never been approached at their home by white people.
Right.
And they've never been solicitous in no one's ever come up to them and valued their opinions of life.
Right. Right. And like you said, the taking of their pictures, in many cases, they kind of dressed up a little bit. The men
absolutely
like to have a jacket on, you know, and look their best. And why not? And particularly when you read the narratives about what it was like to be enslaved and the kind of clothing that you had there, I think that makes it particularly important that they are seen in their best clothes, as if to say, this is the way I choose to dress. This is not the way I dressed when I didn't have any say-so.
Absolutely. And I think that these are faces of resistance and resilience and
yeah.
great beauty.
Yes. Now, you guys looked at, you and Michael Williams,
right.
Y'all looked through a couple of thousand photographs before you chose the over 100 or so that are in River of Blood, right?
We did. We wanted to find people that spoke well and eloquently and who were photographed well. Not that they were, you know, there were some photographs that were literally out of focus, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, so we were really trying for this combination of words and pictures. On every single spread, there's a photograph, there's a quote, and there's a paragraph that explains who this person was and what happened to them in life.
Do we want to talk about specificity? Do you want to go through the book? And were there ones that were, I know this is like asking what's your favorite child.
Oh, yeah, no, but I can't explain it because it's not just a random group of quotes. We picked six or seven topics to really delve into and talk about. And we set it up so that it's almost, I don't know if you noticed this, but it's almost like a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
One person stops talking and the other person starts talking about a very similar subject. So the book, as an example, starts with a really look at identity, and we do, you know, we hear the words of a woman by the name of Mary Ann Burleson, who says that she's not quite sure when she was born. There's a 5-year period that she knows she was born in, and she doesn't even know where she was born. So speaking about identity, here's a person who's close to 100 and still doesn't know these very basic facts. And a very distinguished man by the name of Bill Homer in Texas said he was given away as a wedding gift by his slaveholder.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking to myself, what does this do to a person, you know, in life? I think that this book says a lot about the past, but it says a lot about the present and the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this chapter, many people talked about slave trading. They talked about watching enslaved children being sold from their mother's breasts. And one man, James Brown, remembers families crying like they were at a funeral. And sometimes it's actually very funny. One woman explained the whole slave trade and explains how some slaves were rented out to other farms. And she ends by saying, times don't change, just the merchandise.
Yeah, that was a pretty brutal assessment and spot on.
Yeah.
When you look at sharecropping, which became the often the way that in the post-Civil War era, particularly the post-Reconstruction era, that many African-American families found themselves living in a shareholder situation, which is not much different than up north, where they had people who worked for a mining company or something, and they like in the words of the old Tennessee Ernie Ford song, they owed their soul to the company store.
Right.
When you were a sharecropper, you had to borrow all this money to be a farmer, and then hopefully your crop shows up. And if it didn't, you still owed all the money. And if you had a couple of bad years, since they didn't have anything called crop insurance in those days, even if they had, they probably couldn't have afforded it. So if you had a crop or two that was bad, you'd never get out of that debt. For all intents and purposes, you're back being a slave again.
Absolutely. And we looked really carefully at the end of the Civil War and those first few days of freedom. And there were so many surprises. Several people said that they weren't even told that the war was over, that they were free.
Yes.
That the owner of the plantation wanted to keep them on until the next harvest. And there's one person who said he didn't know until he was 21 years old that he was free. So obviously you had that problem. And then you had even a more, well, it's no more serious, but certainly another serious problem, that what do you do now? You've been working as an indentured servant for all of your life. You have no education. You don't know anyone who's free. So do you go, you obviously, most people stuck on the farm, and many people kept working for the former slaveholders because they didn't see any other choices.
Right. That's all they knew to do and all they knew how to do. They were prohibited by law from being educated. And so how do you get out of this system? There were, about, a dozen years or so of Reconstruction where there was light breaking through for the formerly enslaved people. The 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment get passed. Things are looking up. You have black people who are elected to positions of authority and influence. And then Reconstruction is over, and it takes about another 12 years, and everything's pretty much back where it was.
Right, and they talked about this in detail, and they also talked a lot about the effect of the Ku Klux Klan on their communities and on themselves, whether they personally were affected or what they saw. This was a real thing. It's not something that was made up years later by Hollywood.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, to Rich Cahan, and he, along with Michael Williams, are the authors of an extraordinary book called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, Interviews and Photographs of Formerly Enslaved African Americans from City Files Press. It's got over 100 photographs of people who had been enslaved when they were children and survived and found a way through life. And here they are toward the end of their life, and they are given the opportunity during WPA days to talk about what things were like. Now, you talked about the different sort of categories of topics that you guys discussed, or that you guys, how you guys grouped the book, so that I think it'd be good for us to talk about that.
Sure.
Let's take a moment and talk about these how you arrived at these topics, and
sure.
Was it as a result of what you found, or
it was really we let the words lead us. We're the editors of this book, but we're far from being the writers. There's a beauty to the writing, and we really wanted to just organize it. So, as we said, we started with identity, and then we literally looked at day-to-day life, what it was like on the plantation and on the farms during those years, and people were very clear about just the suffering that went on. The cabins had dirt floors, and oftentimes the food was served in troughs, and they were constantly hungry. They, as I mentioned, they weren't taught to read or write. They oftentimes couldn't really handle money. Some of the plantations had dungeons. So, I think that, I'll say this for myself. I read about all this stuff in high school, and I've read about books, obviously, since then. But to hear it from people's words, and there was no these people weren't being, you know, they weren't being lauded for being honest. They just thought it was very important. And I think that by hearing this firsthand account really made a difference. We then did a section on violence, and you could imagine, you know, the cruelty of masters and overseers. Overseers were generally African Americans, but they were put in that position because they were expected to get the most work from slaves, and that must have been a terribly difficult position to be in.
Sort of like being Jewish and being a trustee over the others in the concentration camp must have been.
Exactly right. You know, obviously, many tales of whippings, many tales of beatings, dogs searching for them, the idea of escape. I think one thing that really struck us were how many women talked about how they were forced to be in the fields until late in their pregnancy. And that was one thing, but then they were forced to go back in the fields while they were still nursing. And oftentimes their children were kind of tied up in hammocks and trees. And so there was really no relief, the hard work. They started usually before dawn, the horn would blow, and they would work the field until late at night. But it's also, I think, a book of resistance. They talked a lot about praying silently to themselves. They obviously talked about the idea of escape and how, you know, they thought about it, I think, most every day. And they also talked about a lot. There were several stories about how they refused to acknowledge pain, you know, during beatings. And I thought that was very telling.
Yeah. The brutal truth that they tell, the title of the book should give you a clue as to this. The title of the book is River of Blood. That comes from a direct quote from one of these formerly enslaved people who was a child when they saw this occur, that someone, and this is more than one person talked about witnessing someone else, a family member or someone that they knew certainly, being beaten to a pulp with a whip and then salt rubbed in the wounds or lard or just horrendous stuff.
Yeah. There's the word blood came up often in the book, and you were talking about that. There's a man from South Carolina. His name is Ben Horry, and he told a story that I thought was, well, they're all very distressing.
Yeah.
But he talks about watching his mother being whipped and having his father stand next to him and kind of holding him because neither his father or he were allowed to lift a hand against that.
Yeah, they wouldn't dare because they'd be beaten too. And
exactly.
There was one quote about a judge who came along. Someone had committed murder. One of those enslaved had committed murder, killed an overseer and ran off. And they caught him and they were going to burn him alive. And the judge said he wouldn't burn a dog alive.
Right.
And then
right.
After he left, they burned the guy.
Exactly. You know, I wrote a book about the incarceration of Japanese Americans several years ago, and I was always looking for heroes and villains, and I always could find some heroes, people who stood up for Japanese Americans during World War II. But in this book, there aren't a lot of, you know, there really aren't a lot of heroes.
No, it doesn't seem like anybody thought that this wasn't okay.
Right.
Except the people who were being brutalized, of course.
Right.
It just sort of makes you sick to your stomach. And there are pages and pages and pages and various creative ways to inflict pain on other people and so forth.
But I also think I hope we don't lead the readers astray in that there's also an important eloquence in the way these men and women talked. And oftentimes they talked in what's now called dialect. And there was a time where we thought we would kind of quote, I'm putting quote marks, clean up that dialogue, but that dialect. But once you start reading it, you see the beauty in it all and the kind of poeticism of it. And once you kind of translate in your mind, it doesn't take long. It takes, you know, a couple of you're confused. It's kind of like when you start reading Huckleberry Finn and you go, oh my gosh, I don't understand this. But if you just read a couple paragraphs, you'll pick it up very quickly.
Right.
And you see the profundity of these people and their optimism, their singing in the fields, and their knowing that freedom will someday come to them. And I think ultimately it's more of a, I'm not going to say it's an uplifting story, but it's certainly a story of the determination of humans to withstand the worst.
And perseverance.
Yes.
It talks about, they talk about how awful it was when the Klan was riding,
right,
and how terrifying they were. But again, what comes shining through is that that they're not going to let the bad guys win.
Exactly. And you kind of see that end of the story by looking at their pictures. And as you said, they knew exactly how important those pictures would be, even though it's taken us, you know, 100 years to find them.
Yeah.
You know, that's the wonderful thing about photography. They don't go away. And these people are standing so straight and so proud and so determined and so pleased that they've finally been asked their story.
We're getting kind of close to the end of our time together, and I wanted to mention one particular quote. And this is from a lady, Margaret Nillen, born into slavery about 1847 in Palestine, Texas. Her father was sold just before her birth. After the war, she and her mother sewed to make a living. She married and raised at least one child, with whom she was living in Fort Worth. She was 90 when this photograph was made and when she talks. And here's what she said. What do I like best, to be slave or free? Well, it's this way. In slavery, I own nothing and never owned anything. In freedom, I own a home and raise a family. All that causes me worry, and in slavery, I had no worries. But I take the freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. The sweet taste of freedom.
Yeah.
And as hard as it is for everybody.
I think the truth is so important for us to know that even when it's not what we'd like to learn, that we need to. I think that I was, several years ago, whenever Saving Private Ryan came out, and I had a friend who called me up and said, "Now, I know you were never in combat. I just want to warn you, they had a screening of this movie for a bunch of us veterans to see how accurate it was, and it is very accurate, and it is very gruesome." He said, I'm kind of wondering if you really need to go see it. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Sir, with all due respect, I think I owe it to all of you guys who went through that to see it, no matter how awful it is, because I need to be reminded that it wasn't easy." And I kind of feel the same way about this book, in a sense that I can't imagine what it's like to be enslaved. There is certainly no, as far as I know, none of my recent ancestors that had to suffer under that system. But we need to know, and we need to know on behalf of those who were. And we also need to know that they, no matter what happened, they kept their heads up, and they should be an inspiration to us, as well as a chastisement to people who look down on others because of their physical differences.
Absolutely, and it's important for all of us to know, African Americans, whites, the entire country.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Rich, it is quite an extraordinary book. River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, Interviews and Photographs of Formerly Enslaved African Americans, from City Files Press, beautifully bound and available at bookstores everywhere. Do you have a website?
We do. People can learn more about the book and order it directly from us at City Files Press, all one word, city and then F-I-L-E-S, press.com.
All right, very good. And we'll mention that again before the time is over. Rich, it's great to get a chance to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I appreciate you so much making time. Thank you so much for arranging for me to get the book.
Oh, I'm thrilled to talk to you and your listeners. Alabama plays a really important role in this book. Both several of the formerly enslaved men and women had been transported to Alabama from the East Coast when they were very young, and many of them left Alabama for Texas. Greener pastures in Texas as the war continued. So I would say about a third or a quarter of the people interviewed had Alabama connections in this book.
Right. It certainly behooves us to take a look at these pictures, to read these these words to be reminded of how awful it was. I remember 30-something years ago when the TV series Roots came out, and white people were shocked to realize how really brutal slavery was and the cost to those who were enslaved. And my black friend said, well, I'm glad that you understand a little bit about why some of us are unhappy. But it's not really a surprise to us because we've heard the stories. They get passed down through the family.
Exactly.
And there was nothing I could say other than I'm just so sorry that this situation existed, and even more upset about the fact that most people saw nothing wrong with it.
Right, and it still affects our society today because there's a legacy that must be recognized, I think, for all of us.
Rich, thank you again with us. This is a powerful book. I thank you for sharing it with us and for being with us here on the bookshelf, and thank you again.
Thank you so much, Doc. I enjoyed this very much. Thank
you.
This is the first interview I've had, and it's so nice that you're so candid and appreciative. It means a lot to me.
Well, absolutely. And next book, we'll just do this again.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rich.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Our thanks once again to Rich Kalin. Our thanks once again to our guest today, Rich Kalin, who, along with Michael Williams, are the editors of this extraordinary book, River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, from City Files Press. And you can check their website, cityfilespress.com, to learn more about this book and the others that are available from them. These are beautiful books and a powerful testimony. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that you've enjoyed our series during February, observing American History Month and Black History Month. And next week, we've got another special one, so be sure to tune in. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.